Get it done.
Revolution Radio, where we do the nasty work. www.freedomslips.com.
Hey guys, Scorpio here. Join me every Saturday at 2 p.m. here on Studio A for the Scorpio Conspiracy Show, where we discuss the hidden agendas that impact our lives and uncover the secret societies and the shadowy elite who construct the reality that we are supposed to believe. So be there Saturdays, 2 p.m. Eastern Time, here on Studio A on Revolution Radio, and learn what's really going down.
Lost a little honey on the lone highway, left me for another on the lone highway. They killed Dirty Dog McGee on the lone highway.
I think him, he has been an inspiration in my radio career.
You must be some kind of a kook.
Thank you.
It's hard out here for a pimp.
All right, listen up, y'all.
A bunch of a-holes.
Where are you gonna go? Where are you gonna run? Where are you gonna hide?
Ladies and gentlemen, may I have your attention?
Ejector systems are offline.
Mario!
Hashtag confused, dude.
What kind of feeling? I'm high on believing that you're in love with me.
I'm not good enough.
Happy Monday, plebs. You know, I need to get a new set of headphones because these things are shorting out. I have to hold the, I think it's because the mute and volume button are on the cord itself, and I think it's just worn down. Anyway, this is Mario. Welcome to the big program. This, that, and the other, heard every Monday and Thursday from 6 until 8 p.m. Eastern Time here on Revolution.radio. Common spelling, 503 Central Time. 603 East Coast, 403 Mountain, 303 West Coast, 1103, 36 degrees in Reykjavik, Iceland, and over the big water hole, Sydney, Australia. Happy Tuesday, 10:03 in the morning, in a balmy 73 degrees. It was a balmy 30 degrees today, and it got to a high of 30. So, hello, kids. Let's say hello to some of the folks in the chat room this morning. Apparently, some people were being thrown under the bus before this program, and I do not know why. It's always amazing to me. But you know what gets you in the mood? Talking over Marvin Gaye and sexual heat. Excuse me, 36 people are currently online. 52 others have visited the room in the last 24 hours. In total, there are 464 visitors on the list. We're not going to name them all. The list does include 7 admins, 5 moderators, 187 trusted. I am one. 244 allowed, 2 banned, and 19 blocked. Just me. Shit heels. As somebody once called me during my time as a Perkins cook, waitress. Forget her name. Holding your shit. I was impressed. Mitzi, hello. Tootsie, S, Weird Engineer, Greenheart, Numeral 1, Wally the Movie, Jimmy, Jean, Valerie, Mario, that's me, Rudolph, My Fly Guy, Eagle Flower, Comet, The Kraken, which I still think is a whisper, Open Philosopher, Monster 383, Jeeples, Salt Rosenberg, Main Street 13, Rot, Flippy, Favorite Chatter, Pet, Bestest, B as in Tenacity, Pets, Tenacity, change their name. It was registered 4 months ago. Trust your account. Maybe they're not trusted. Voice Element, Jack Pop, Sunflower, Batsman, Batsman, Hazardous Base, Jerbin. Well, my fine circuit. Travis Man, not much to Greenberg, Mega, Useless Riffa, my favorite host. Pulling up the rear. Mr. Rowe. Get up. All right, Marvin, that's enough. Just calm down. Calm down. Calm down, brah. As the kids say on the street, spelled B-R-U-H, as a pro, opposed to bro. Why do people send me text messages when I am busy doing the award-winning show? This is why you put your phone on Do Not Disturb. All right, folks, this is what's going on this evening on the fine program. A little visit with the disgraced Bill Cosby, one of his classic routines at some point. We will also discuss why UFO sightings are persuasive, I'm sorry. What dating looks like in 2020 according to some Tinder data. whether or not you're dating a sociopath. Some terrifying truck killer stories. Apparently 9 people who were committed based on hypnosis. And we'll visit our friends of our bedtime stories. But as promised, before the show began, Mitzi, I believe, was concerned there wasn't enough comedy on Revolution Radio. So for Mitzi's pleasure and yours, here I now present to you between 5 and 10 jokes. Now, I'm not going to qualify these jokes as bad or good. I'm just going to say they're jokes. And you decide. Now, there's a bit of a delay between me talking in the chat room, so I'll give you some time to answer the punchline. Here we go. Joke number one. Well, these are clean jokes, so you can say these at family dinners or during Christmas dinner or what have you. Joke number one. What does a clock do when it's hungry? Joke number one. What does a clock do when it's hungry? I would play the Jeopardy music, but I believe that's copyrighted, and I don't want the program or the station to be DMAC'd or whatever the acronym is for violating some copyright music law. Again, joke number one. What does a clock do when it's hungry? The punchline, it goes back 4 seconds. You get it? It's a clock. All right. Joke number two. What do you call a belt made of watches? What do you call a belt made of watches? Dude, this is horrible. Joke number two. What do you call a belt made of watches? The punchline. A waste of time. You get it because it's a belt made of watches and you put it around your waist. So it's a waste made of time. Okay, just one more joke, Pat. One more joke. I'll only do three because Pat's probably already just annoyed with this. Okay, here you go. Here we go. Joke number three, and this is the final joke. Joke number three. What do you call a pony with a sore throat? The final joke, because Pat Rabbit is already moaning. What do you call a pony with a sore throat? The punchline, a little horse. Because a come on. Okay, just one more. These are so bad, they're funny. Come on, one more. So this is the fourth and final joke, because I think Pat is really enjoying these. He's probably writing them down, and he's going to entertain everybody with them. Okay. Final joke. Excuse me. What kind of car does an egg drive? What kind of car does an egg drive? The fourth and final joke, I believe. Yes, Pat, you got that the joke right. What kind of car does an egg drive? Are you ready? A yolks wagon. See the play on words there? Listen, I'll tell you right now. Kids under the age of 8 will love any of those four jokes. And don't ask me to repeat them to you because I don't remember. But people would love it. Okay, so let's get into the serious business now. According to Real Clear Science, research shows diversity training is typically... That's pretty good too, Pat, but it was a yolks wagon. A yolks wagon. Research shows diversity training is typically ineffective. Now, the reason I like Real Clear Science, the website, is because after each little blurb, they provide the full references that you can go and search yourself, and in most cases, they are hyperlinked. In the wake of George Floyd's killing and the protests that followed, many colleges and universities have been rolling out new training requirements, often orientated towards reducing biases and encouraging people from high-status groups to, quote, check their privilege, end quote. The explicit goal of these training programs is generally to help create a more positive and welcoming institutional environment for people from historically marginalized and underrepresented groups. Again, reading from Real Clear Science, the title, Research Shows Diversity Training is Typically Ineffective. Although the precursor to contemporary diversity training, sensitivity training, actually dates back to the mid-1940s, diversity training became especially important beginning in the mid-1980s and early 90s. Why, you ask? Starting in the late 70s through the early 80s, universities began enrolling significantly higher numbers of women, minorities, and people from middle class and lower income backgrounds. Soon thereafter, employers found themselves with a much more heterogeneous labor pool. Bunch of different folks. So that $3 word means. They had to face, often for the first time, some of the challenges that came along with the benefits of diversity. As people with increasingly different, divergent backgrounds and perspectives were put side by side and tasked with common goals. Now, beginning in the mid-90s, however, it became increasingly clear that, due to their lack of validation, many widely used interventions could be ineffective or harmful. An empirical literature was built up measuring the effectiveness of diversity-related training programs. The picture that has emerged is not very flattering. The limited research suggesting diversity-related training programs as... Wait, one second. My headset is cracking out, so hang on a minute. I think I got it. Sorry. The limited research suggesting diversity-related training programs as impactful was based on things like surveys before and after the training, or testing knowledge or attitudes about various groups or policies. And to be clear, the training does help people answer survey questions in a way that the training said they should. And many people who undergo the training say they enjoyed it or found it helpful in post-training questionnaires. I've been to several of these diversity training seminars, and I find them a complete waste of my time. Just so you know. Just one man's opinion. One biracial man's opinion. However, when scientists set about to investigate whether the programs actually change behaviors, in other words, do they reduce expressions of bias, do they reduce discrimination, do they foster greater collaboration across groups, do they help with retaining employees from historical marginalized or underrepresented groups, do they increase productivity or reduce conflicts in the workplace, for all of these behavior metrics, the metrics that actually matter, not only is the training ineffective, it is often counterproductive. Let's repeat that, because I think this is important. When scientists set about to investigate whether the programs actually changed behaviors, in other words, do they reduce expressions of bias? Do they reduce discrimination? Do they foster greater collaboration across groups? Do they help with retaining employees from historically marginalized and underrepresented groups? Do they increase productivity or reduce conflicts in the workplace? For all these metrics, which are important, not only is the training ineffective, it is often counterproductive. The stated goals of these training programs vary from helping to increase hiring and retention of people from historically marginalized and underrepresented groups to eliminating prejudicial attitudes or behaviors to members of said groups, to reducing conflict and enhancing cooperation and belonging among all employees. Irrespective of the stated goals of the programs, they are overwhelmingly ineffective with respect to those goals. In other words, these are the stated goals. This is the purpose of the training. By the end of this training, one should be able to analyze, one should be able to describe, one should be able to practice. However, they're ineffective. Generally speaking, they do not increase diversity in the workplace. They do not reduce harassment or discrimination. They do not lead to greater intergroup cooperation and cohesion. Consequently, they do not increase productivity. Most striking, many of those tasked with ensuring compliance with these training programs recognize them as ineffective. Article published from Rhines and Rosen from 1995. Another point of the ineffectiveness, training often reinforces biases. Often when people attempt to do fact checks, they begin by underscoring, or in other words, highlighting the falsehood, and then proceed to try to debunk that falsehood. This can create what psychologists call an illusionary truth effect, where people end up remembering the falsehood and forgetting the correction, and then attributing their misinformation to the very source that had tried to correct it. A similar effect seems to hold with anti-bias training. By articulating various stereotypes associated with particular groups, emphasizing the salience of those stereotypes, and then calling for their suppression, they often end up reinforcing them in participants' minds. Sometimes they even implant new stereotypes. For example, if participants didn't previously have particular stereotypes for Vietnamese people or much knowledge about them overall, but were introduced to common stereotypes about the group through training intended to dispel said stereotypes. So in other words, you go to a training, they give you a whole list of stereotypes that they claim are inaccurate, but that they claim are false, and then try to debunk those stereotypes. People leave the training most often only remembering the stereotypes and not the debunking. Other times, they can fail to improve negative perceptions about the target group, yet increase negative views about others. For instance, an empirical investigation of, quote, white privilege training found that it did nothing to make participants more sympathetic to minorities. It just increased resentment towards lower-income whites. Encouraging people to ignore racial and cultural differences often results in diminished cooperation across racial lines. Meanwhile, multicultural training, emphasizing those differences, often ends up reinforcing race essentialism among participants. It is not clear what the best position between these poles is, such that these negative side effects can be avoided, let alone how to consistently strike the balance in training. Training often alienates people from high-status groups, reduces morale. Diversity-related training programs often depict people from historically marginalized and disenfranchised groups as important and worthwhile, celebrating their heritage and culture while criticizing the dominant culture as fundamentally depraved, racist, sexist, sadistic, etc. People from minority groups are discussed in overwhelmingly positive terms, while people from majority groups are characterized as typically and uniquely ignorant, insensitive, or outright malicious with respect to those who are different than them. Yes, it's if you are white, you are a very bad person. And if you are a marginalized person of color, as it's categorized now, or if you are any ist, these are all the great things about you. Everybody else is bad. members of the majority group are told to listen to and validate the perspectives of people from historically and marginalized or disadvantaged groups, even as they are instructed to submit their own feelings and perspectives to intense scrutiny. I have been in many of these diversity trainings, and I'm telling you right now, I feel bad for the white folks. I really do. Because they sit there and they are made to feel within 10 minutes that they have to apologize for every act of ism placed upon any person of color from the dawn of man until present day. In short, there is a clear double standard in many of these programs with respect to how members of dominant groups, typically men, whites, and or heterosexual, are described as compared to members of minority groups, in other words, women, ethnic, racial minorities, LGBTQ employees. The result is that many members from the dominant group walk away from the training believing that themselves, their culture, their perspectives, and interests are not valued at the institution, certainly not as much as those of minority team members, reducing their morale and productivity. I will agree with that 90%. However, if you walk away from this group with my attitude that basically says this was a complete waste of my time, you are seen as a sellout Uncle Tom in street smart, which I wear as honorary badges. The training may also lead many to believe that they have to walk on eggshells while engaging with members of minority populations by calling attention not just to clear examples of harm and prejudice, but just as much or more to things like implicit attitudes and microaggressions. Participants come to view colleagues from historical marginalized and disenfranchised groups as fragile and easily offended. Snowflakes, we call them. As a result, members of the dominant group become less likely to try to build relationships or collaborate with people from minority groups. I agree with that 100%. 100%. I can tell when people meet up with me that they are ready. They feel the need to start, I don't know, apologizing or doing something until they hear me talk and hear my views on certain things, and they go, oh, well, you're just kind of like me. Yes. I don't even check boxes. I don't prefer – well, I don't even – I do when I'm required to. But I don't check boxes when I am filling stuff out, you know, race, ethnicity. No, I do. I think I check other. Yeah, it's. I agree with you, Pat. It's nuts. Finally, focus on implicit attitudes. Implicit attitudes are – one of the most commonly relied upon constructs in contemporary diversity-related training. However, there are severe problems with these constructs. As hammered home by meta-analysis after meta-analysis, a meta-analysis is essentially a reanalysis of a bunch of analyses, so a bunch of articles or research that addressed this one similar topic. A meta-analysis is reanalyzing those analyses. It is not clear precisely what is being measured on implicit attitude tests. Implicit attitudes do not effectively predict actual discriminatory behavior. Most interventions to change implicit attitudes are ineffective. Effects, when present, tend to be small and fleeting. Moreover, there is no evidence, I repeat, no evidence that changing implicit attitudes has any significant, let alone durable, impact on reducing biased or discriminatory behaviors. In short, the construct itself has numerous validity issues and the training has no demonstrable benefit. In other words, you show up with an attitude, you're most likely going to leave with that same attitude. Finally, microaggressions. Contemporary diversity-related training often draws significant attention to microaggressions, small, typically inadvertent faux pas involving people from historically marginalized and disadvantaged groups. The cumulative effects of microaggressions are held to have significant and adverse impacts on the well-being of people from low-status groups. However, although the microaggressions framework goes back to 1974, there is virtually no systematic research detailing if and how microaggressions are harmful, for whom, and under what circumstances. Indeed, there is not even robust conceptual clarity in the literature as to what constitutes a microaggression. In other words, How is the term being defined and in what context and for whom? There is no systematic empirical evidence that training on microaggressions has any significant or long-term effects on behavior, nor that it correlates with any other positive institutional outcomes. In fact, when presented with canonical microaggressions, Black and Hispanic respondents overwhelmingly find themselves to be inoffensive. And we have ample reason to believe that sensitizing people to perceive and take greater offense at these slights actually could cause harm. The evidence is clear and abundant that increased perceptions of racism have adverse mental and physical consequences for minorities. In short, not only is there no evidence that training on microaggressions is valuable for improving the well-being of people from historically marginalized and disadvantaged groups, there's no reason to believe it could actually be counterproductive to the end. So, according to this article, diversity training is a complete waste of time, which I have been saying for years. All right, when we come back, folks, we're almost in the bottom of the hour break. We're going to talk about the weird year of pandemic dating, as told by Tinder's 2020 swipe report. And we'll find out why UFO sightings aren't persuasive. Here comes the music. Thanks for listening. I almost said licking. Uh-oh. Freudian slip. Talk to you folks soon.
Travels to Earth through the rainbow crystal bubbles from the furthest reaches of space and time, across the dimensions, through the elements, and in harmony with the colors of the universe. Through her mastery of abstract stream of consciousness malapropisms, she weaves a web of comic, satiric, cosmic conversation. Her subjects can range from Norman, the goose next door, to astrology and earth changes, and into the deep recesses of the soul matrix. She holds a wealth of knowledge on herbs, plants, and astrology. Join Mona and her guests on Adventures of a Feral Hippie as she touches the earthly radio waves 5 days a week at 2 p.m. Monday to Friday on Studio B at Revolution Radio.
Be evasive.
But that doesn't mean that they're telling the truth as opposed to fiction.
And Genesis chapter 6, verse 4, and there were giants in the earth in those days, and also after that, when the sons of God came and unto the daughters of men, indicating that there were giants before the Nephilim.
And sons of God, plural. They weren't talking about Jesus coming down.
No, that's right. Yeah.
I'm Steve Crawford, host of Factor Theory Live. Join me every Sunday night from 10 p.m. till midnight Eastern Standard Time on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. Check it out.
Oscar's freeze. That's your cerebral cortex looking for an answer it doesn't have.
See? Even your brain knows you're screwed.
That is filling with adrenaline right now. Whether you know it or not, your heart's beating fast. It's getting a little harder to breathe. The neurobiological system is telling it to run, but your knees are too weak to move.
Fear is not real. The only place that fear can exist is in our thoughts of the future. It is a product of our imagination, causing us to fear things that do not at present and may not ever exist. That is near insanity. Do not misunderstand me. danger is very real, but fear is a choice. We are all telling ourselves a story.
You're listening to Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. 100% listener-supported radio. Reporting the danger, unafraid, right here, where information never sleeps. Revolution. Revolution. Radio!
All right. Thanks for listening while we took that short break here at Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. And yeah, we're going to get back to your host.
Forced Inside Hook, Sex and Dating, dated December 7th, 2020. A weird year of pandemic dating, as told by Tinder's 2020 swipe year and swipe report. It was a sad, hard year, but we didn't let that get in the way of our swiping habits. Quite the opposite, in fact. With real-life interaction stalled amid the pandemic, online dating not only survived, but it thrived in 2020. As homebound singles increasingly turned to dating apps out of boredom and or sheer desperation for human contact, apps got a front-row seat to love in pandemic times, and Tinder captured it all. I'm going to tell you right now, I've seen Tinder. It's a bit of a hookup app, or it used to be. Listen, I'm going to tell you right now. You can imagine what people do on apps or programs that allow you to visually see each other. So I think most folks' sexual needs were met regardless of being stuck at home. And I'm of the opinion that more people were likely to engage in those acts because of sheer boredom or the desperation for human contact, even if it's just eyes looking you up and down. The platform that launched the app dating boom back in 2012 just released its annual year in swipe report, revealing all the ways the various trends and trails of 2020 spilled over into our dating lives this year. From pandemic pickup lines to Carol Baskin shoutouts, this was dating in 2020, as told by Tinder. Swiping was up big time. We may all have been busy navigating a Russian nesting doll of global crises this year, but we still found plenty of time to swipe our little hearts out. According to Tinder, both messaging and swiping on the app were up double digits by the end of the year compared to the distant pre-pandemic days of February. Quote, in an unprecedented year when faced with new obstacles, Tinder members adapted and got creative about how they connected, reads the release. With IRL, known as in-real-life interactions, off the table for most, dating apps became a lifeline for many singles, with Tinder proving, in quote, an essential survival tool for its largely Gen G user base. According to Tinder, pandemic pickup lines mentioning quarantine and chill, hand-washing, and other COVID-19 talking points took over the platform in March, while mask talk was up nearly 10 times compared to 2019, a much simpler time when most people would have had no reason to be talking about masks at all, much less flirting about them. Just so you know, quarantine and chill is a rebranding of Netflix and chill, which was code for, why don't you come over and we can hook up, just so you know. Finally, why UFO sightings are so persuasive. If intelligent aliens visited the Earth, it would be one of the most profound events in human history, and I'm waiting for it. Surveys show that nearly half of Americans believe that aliens have visited the Earth, either in the ancient past or recently. That percentage has been increasing. Belief in alien visitation is greater than belief in Bigfoot, that Bigfoot is a real creature, but less than belief that places can be haunted by spirits. Scientists dismiss these beliefs as not representing real physical phenomena. They don't deny the existence of intelligent aliens, but they set a high bar for proof that we haven't been visited by creatures from another star system. That we have been. As Carl Sagan said, extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. There's a long history of UFO sightings. Air Force studies of UFOs have been going on since the 1940s. And the U.S. ground zero for UFOs occurred in 1947, the famous Roswell, New Mexico crash. The fact that the Roswell incident was soon explained as the crash landing of a military high-altitude balloon didn't stem a tide of new sightings. The majority of UFOs appear to people in the United States. It's curious that Asia and Africa have so few sightings despite their large populations, and even more surprising that the sightings stop at the Canadian and Mexican borders. Most UFOs have mundane explanations. Over half can be attributed to meteors, fireballs, and the planet Venus. Such bright objects are familiar to astronauts but are often not recognized by members of the public. Reports of visits from UFOs inexplicitly peaked about 6 years ago. Many people who say they have seen UFOs are either dog walkers or smokers. Why? Because they're outside the most. Sightings concentrate in evening hours, particularly on Fridays when many people are relaxing with one or two drinks. So right now we're making a correlation between alcohol and sightings. A few people, like former NASA employee James Oberg, have the fortitude to track down and find conventional explanations for decades of UFO sightings. Most astronomers find the hypothesis of alien visits implausible, so they concentrate their energy on the exciting scientific search for life beyond Earth. Are we alone? That's the big question. Well, while UFOs continue to swirl in the popular culture, scientists are trying to answer the big question that is raised by UFOs. Are we alone? Astronomers have discussed over 4,000 exoplanets, or planets orbiting other stars, a number that doubles every 2 years. Some of these exoplanets are considered habitable since they are close to the Earth's mass and at the right distance from their stars to have water on their surfaces. The nearest of these habitable planets are less than 20 light years away in our cosmic backyard. Extrapolating from these results leads to a projection of 300 million habitable worlds in our galaxy. Each of these Earth-like planets is a potential biological experiment, and there have been billions of years since they formed for life to develop and for intelligence and technology to emerge. Astronomers are very confident there is life beyond the Earth. As astronomer and ace exoplanet hunter Jeff Marcy puts it, quote, "The universe is apparently bulging at the seams with the ingredients of biology," end quote. There are many steps in the progression from Earth with suitable conditions for life to intelligent aliens hopping from star to star. Astronomers use the Drake equation to estimate the number of technological alien civilizations in our galaxy. There are many uncertainties in the Drake equation, but interpreting it in the light of recent exoplanet discoveries makes it very unlikely that we are the only or the first advanced civilization. Moving slowly. Next hour, we'll talk about murder people. Moving into some more relationship news. So we went from Tinder to aliens back to relationships. So in case you're interested, 8 signs that you're in a relationship with a sociopath. This is from a woman who apparently married one, almost married one. If you believe the statistics, 3.8% of humans meet the diagnostic criteria for psychopathy. I'm sorry, sociopathy. Psychopathy is the other one. Or antisocial personality disorder, APD, which is a mental health diagnosis characterized by deception as well as lack of empathy and a conscience. So why do my headphones keep rocking out like that? Stand by, sorry. Antisocial personality disorder may exist on a spectrum, but that doesn't necessarily make a sociopath any less dangerous. Here are the signs to look out for, and perhaps you should pay attention. They have extreme charisma. This is Jer Bear. Sociopaths are usually extremely self-assured and charismatic. They truly believe that they are better looking and more talented and thus entitled to anything and everything life has to offer. They move fast in a relationship. On your second date with a sociopath, they could be already talking marriage. In a few weeks, they might be suggesting you move in together. Within a month, they could be professing their undying love and dreams for you, for your shared future. They paint the perfect movie-quality picture of what life could be like with them, and you soak up every delicious fantasy. They tell lie upon lie. Sociopaths lie as easily as they breathe. They don't want to share with you. Apparently, they want to keep their toys to themselves. They don't want to play with others. Even you. You belong to them. They guilt trip you. They're verbally and physically abusive. The one emotion sociopaths do feel is anger, or more often than not, rage. They take pleasure in others' misfortune. They court danger. Sociopaths are reckless. They are not one to turn down a dare or play by the rules. They think that nothing will ever happen to them, so they risk big. Well, now, according to the DSM-5, I think they're on, you'd have to go through there because just because you may have some of these signs does not mean that you are a sociopath, just so you know. Murderous intentions. Is this for next hour? Yes, I think that's for next hour, because next hour we will learn about Amy Alwyn. The reason we're going to learn about Amy Alwyn is because it's a case from my state, Minnesota, where a preacher staged his wife's own death and would have gotten away with it. But, and that's a big disclaimer, but, and then we'll also visit our friends over at Bedtime Stories next hour. But, I will tell you this, there may or may not have been a dark web circling the church, and there may or may not have been a mistress. And there may or may not have been someone hired. I'm just saying. A lot of may or may not have been that occurred. This is for Mitzi. Mitzi, this is for you. You were concerned that there wasn't enough comedy on Revolution Radio. So, for your listening enjoyment, a classic from the now disgraced Bill Cosby, for your listening pleasure.
Now, the same thing happens every night. We have 5 children. They sit in the center. My wife is at this end, I'm at this end. And our children enjoy their dinner because my wife allows them to listen to their music. So you get to... And the children eat and they... I don't look at them. I just keep... Now, my wife looks the situation over, and she can tell when the children are not going to eat anymore. See, she can tell. They've fooled around long enough. All right, now, you fooled around long enough. Everybody get up from the table. My wife says this every night. Everybody get up from the table, go upstairs, take off all your clothes, get into the shower. Please turn on the water. You have to tell them to do that. Because if you don't, they'll just wander around the tub. And then get out and get in the bed. Please use soap. That's mostly for my son. Rinse yourselves off. Dry yourselves off. Put on clean pajamas. Get into the bed and go to sleep. Now, if these brain-damaged children would do that, there would be no beatings. But there's going to be a beating tonight. And the children get up to go upstairs, and I kiss them goodnight, and I try to warn them. Please, do what your mother says, or somebody's going to get it tonight. And the children kiss me, and they pat me on my head, and they smile and look at me as if to say, dear man, thank you for your kindness and your wonderful attitude about this whole situation. But you don't understand. We cannot sleep through the night unless we've had a good beating. And so they go upstairs, and I can tell they're going to get it because they've started already before they even get upstairs. Will you stop touching me? And you're touching me. You're touching me. Mine! Now they get upstairs, and all you hear is... Now my wife talks to the ceiling. All right up there. I know you don't want me to come up there. I don't hear any water running. Now downstairs comes our 7-year-old. The informer. This is the same child that my wife sends with me whenever I'm going out somewhere. The informer's favorite words are, guess what? I'm a mom. Innis is upstairs, and so I'm going to get into the shower, and so then he took the towel and popped me on my behind. Go upstairs and tell Innis I said not to do that anymore. But my mom already told him, so then he took the towel, so and guess what? Innis popped me in on the behind with the towel, so I said, Innis, I'm going to tell Mom or you. Go upstairs and tell him I said not to do it again and take your clothes off. Okay, but I know he's just going to pop me in the behind again because he's always popping people. 4 minutes later, downstairs comes the 4-year-old. She is naked and wet. Shampoo in her hair has run into her eye. She's running in place and yelling. Walking with her, also naked and wet, with a smile on her face, is the informer. See, Mom, I told you. And it took and poured water on the baby and the shampoo run into her eye, and she may be blinded for life. Now my son, who is 11 years old, comes downstairs. He has on his pajamas. They are stuck to his body because he forgot to dry himself. Mom, I'm trying to take a shower upstairs, and so then they come in the shower. I told them I'm too grown for them to be showering with me. I don't want them. The baby turns and kicks him. The 7-year-old punches him. He punches the baby. Shoves the 7-year-old. They're fighting. My wife turns around, grabs a yardstick. She holds it like a samurai warrior. She then makes an announcement that the beatings will now begin by saying, I have had enough of this. Now, these three brain-damaged people have the nerve to look surprised. My wife says, shh. Children run everywhere. Now, my job is I am the goalie. The children come at me, I kick them back into play. Now, the beatings are over, not because I see my wife, but because I hear all of upstairs going, now, here's the funny part. My wife comes downstairs with the broken stick, throws it on the table, sits down, and begins to talk out loud to nobody. Gonna tell me that you are not going to do something when I tell you to do something. I mean, you move when I say move. Think I carried you in my body for 9 months so you can roll your eyes at me? I'll roll that little head of yours down on the floor. You don't know who you're fooling with. I'll beat you until you can't grow anymore. So funny. My wife and I didn't ask for this. We just asked for some children we could send to college.
All right, the comedic excellence of the now disgraced Bill Cosby. Speaking of Bill Cosby, dated December 1st of this year, Pennsylvania Supreme Court pointedly questions use of prior bad acts witnesses in Bill Cosby's trial. Judges on the Pennsylvania Supreme Court questioned and expressed skepticism about the use of five prior bad acts witnesses in Bill Cosby's criminal trial during an appeal hearing on Tuesday. Cosby, 83, is more than 2 years into his 3 to 10 year sentence at a prison outside Philadelphia for drugging and sexually assaulting Andrea Constant, a former Temple University employee at Cosby's home in 2004. Three assault charges in the case centered on Constant's testimony, but at the criminal trial, Montgomery County Judge Stephen O'Neill allowed five other women, including supermodel Janice Dickinson, to testify as prior bad act witnesses, who said that Cosby had similarly drugged them with the intent of assaulting them in previous incidences. Cosby's attorney, Jennifer Bongean, argued Tuesday in the virtual hearing that these witnesses unfairly prejudiced the jury, and some judges suggested they agreed. Quote, I tend to agree that this evidence was extraordinarily prejudicial to your client, Justice Max Baer said to Bongean. The Supreme Court is made up of seven members and at least four sharply questioned Assistant District Attorney Adrian Jappe, who argued for the prosecution. She argued that the prior bad acts witnesses showed Cosby had a common scheme or plan in his assault. She also said their testimony showed Cosby did not make a mistake or accident in his actions. Quote, this was an historic day for me, Bill Cosby, but it became a beacon of hope for those countless American citizens of the Keystone State and Pennsylvania correctional facilities whose constitutional rights may have been grossly abused because they lacked resources and means to fight prosecutorial corruption, he said in a statement. I'm so happy because I hope and truly believe justice will prevail. So there is your Bill Cosby update. Now, whether or not he gets out anytime soon, I don't know. I have no idea. Otherwise, folks, we're nearing the top of the hour break. Next hour, we'll learn about the Amy Alwyn preacher case. We will. That'll take about the first portion of the break. Probably have to cut it off before the bottom of the hour because it's about 30 minutes. And we may or may not have time to visit our friends over at Bedtime Stories this week, but we can do that for Wednesday. But again, Revolution Radio at revolution.radio. Any web browser will get you there. Hop on over, click on the store tab, click on the donations tab, click on the auctions tab, click on the advertisement tab. Those are all ways to support us. We are 100% listeners funded. One free way to support us, though, head over to revolution.radio, create a chat name, get your account verified or trusted or whatever happens, and talk with the now 34 people hanging out in the chat room this evening. Some of these fine people will be more than happy to not throw you under the bus. Otherwise, the music starts shortly. Get up, stretch your legs, grab some H2O or a beverage of your choice, and we will talk. Me, myself, and the mouse in my pocket will talk with you shortly. Thanks for listening.
To act as a sort of executive officer for the week.
Yes.
But all the decisions of that officer have to be ratified at a special bi-weekly meeting.
Yes, I see.
By a simple majority in the case of purely internal affairs.
Be quiet.
But by a two-thirds majority in the case of more...
Be quiet. I order you to be quiet.
Look, you stupid bastard. You've got no arms left.
Yes, I have.
Look.
It's just a flesh wound.
I don't believe I've seen such a display of courage, skill, nerve, grace, stupidity.
I'll do you for that. No. What? Come here. What are you going to do, bleed on me? I'm invincible.
You're a loony.
The Black Knight's always triumphs.
Roundtable Live, Monday through Friday, 1 a.m. till 4 a.m. Eastern Time. Bring your mind, bring your ideas, bring your voice. King Arthur had nothing on us. Here, Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com.
Enter into a world unseen on Raven Star's Witching Hour. You will encounter eclectic topics from the realm of spirit brought into our matrix of truth. With your host, the Solaris Blue Raven, Solaris will bring you an array of unique guests covering topics from ghostly spirits to amazing anomalies, covert technology, UFOs, and shadowy global events.
And that's right here, Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, Saturdays, midnight till 2 a.m. Eastern Time. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
Let the magic rise.
Revolution Radio.
You don't see it, do you? How close we are to absolute chaos. The sick ones are sitting on their fat asses, eating and drinking themselves into a stupor, polluting the world without a second thought while it goes down the toilet. Nobody wants to do the nasty work. You know, the shit that we all just think about. Most good citizens are just along for the ride and then bitch and moan and complain about everything when it doesn't work out. Not me. Get it done.
Revolution Radio, where we do the nasty work. www.freedomslips.com. All right,
Thanks for listening while we took that short break here at Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. And yeah, we're going to get back to your host.
All right, folks, we're listening to Pleasure.
All right, folks, let's sit back and enjoy this week's edition of, what are we calling this? Morons Who Murder People.
911, what's the address of the emergency?
I think my wife shot herself. There's blood all over.
Shot herself with a gun?
It looks like it.
A gut-wrenching scene plays out during a 911 call. A young boy is the first to find his mother shot to death inside their home.
Does she still have the weapon?
I don't know. We just got
home. Where did
she
shoot herself?
I don't know. I just saw her in blood.
Busy trying to console his son, Stephen Allwine has little information for the operator.
Okay. Do you see her right now?
No, I'm with my son.
Sir, do you know if she was breathing at all?
I don't. I just got back from dinner.
Okay, would you like to check on her and see if she is, or do you believe that she's beyond help?
Stay there for just a second. They want me to go check on her. Hang on.
Stephen quickly returns to the phone with the tragic news.
Okay.
She's not breathing. I can't tell where she's shot. I don't know.
By now, the 9-year-old boy has figured out his mother is dead. The gun lying near her body.
I don't know, bud.
He wonders what will happen to him and his father.
Are we going to remarry?
I don't know, bud.
When you first walk in, this looks like a suicide.
Yes.
But a closer look reveals something sinister. A killer, hell-bent on taking the life of a preacher's wife. Stephen and Amy Allwine have been married for 20 years. The couple met in college and were immediately bonded by their deep Christian faith.
What's the name of the church they attended?
United Church of God, I believe.
They weren't just members of the church. Stephen was also a preacher.
He was initially a deacon, and then he became a church elder. When you are an elder in the church, you are invited to preach, give sermons. He traveled to do that.
The couple each ran a business out of their home in Cottage Grove, Minnesota. Stephen, an IT specialist. Amy, a dog trainer.
Anyone from the outside looking in would say what about this family?
Typical American loving church-going family.
But on a Sunday night in November, the image of their happy family is shattered by that single gunshot.
Are there any other weapons in the residence, sir?
Yes, there's a shotgun in the room and two rifles downstairs.
Okay, is the shotgun the one she has?
No, she had a handgun.
Just a few hours earlier, Amy Allwine had been steaming pumpkins to make a dessert. But after lunch, Stephen says she wasn't feeling well, so she went to lie down. Around 5:30, he left her alone while he and his son had dinner. When they returned, about 90 minutes later, she was dead.
Is it just you and your son home right now?
Yes.
Okay. Stephen, are you able to just step out of the home with your son so that my officers can see you when they pull up?
Yeah.
Sergeant Randy McAllister of the Cottage Grove Police Department was the first detective on the scene.
You questioned the suicide theory right off the bat.
Yeah, I hadn't completely discarded it yet because some weird things can happen with physical evidence and blood splatter and physics, but it was enough for me to at least put the brakes on.
What stuck out to you?
She was sort of laid out with her arms out to 45 degrees. That's not a normal position for somebody who's just shot themselves in the head.
Another red flag, blood drops around the bedroom.
There were some what we call satellite blood drops outside of the main blood pool itself, which suggests that there was something suspended above that area and dripping blood down.
Also, the position of the gun on Amy's left side.
Her family, who's outside by this time, says she's right-handed.
So there are three red flags immediately sticking out to you.
Right.
Fred Fink is the criminal division chief for Washington County, Minnesota.
So at this point, is the case ruled a suicide?
No, it was ruled undetermined by the medical examiner.
The ruling leads to search warrants and a closer look by crime scene investigators, who soon make some disturbing discoveries.
Blood had been cleaned up in multiple areas in the crime scene.
So we know if someone's committing suicide, they're not coming back from the dead to clean up the crime scene.
Correct.
So there was this huge pool of wiped up blood outside of the master bedroom, as well as then footprints down the hall, into the bathroom, into the laundry room, and back.
The blood wasn't visible to the naked eye, only when detectives use a chemical known as luminol.
We see that on television all the time and wonder if any of that's true, but they sprayed it with luminol, turned off the lights, and it just luminesced.
Even before the blood was spotted using luminol, detectives say it was obvious someone had been doing some cleaning up in the hallway.
The floor is very dirty, a lot of dog hair. But then we step onto the hallway, onto the wood floor, and all the way up to the master bedroom, the wood floor is very clean.
So at this point, the suicide theory is pretty much off the table.
It's looking more and more suspicious and less like suicide but at this point.
A Sunday night ends tragically for Stephen Allwine and his young son. The two return home for dinner to find their wife and mother shot to death.
We believe that the son was the first one to find Amy.
Amy Allwine had been shot one time in the head. A handgun was lying next to her body. At first, Stephen believes his wife had committed suicide.
I think my wife shot herself. There's blood all over.
But cops quickly determined the crime scene says otherwise.
So you think the killer, once he killed her, staged the crime scene, then this person went into a cleanup process?
Yes.
Who would want to murder the preacher's wife? By all accounts, she had no enemies. Amy was well-liked at her church and by the clients of her very popular dog training business.
Her friends and her customers with the dog world, too, loved her. They absolutely loved her.
But very few of those people knew Amy. She had actually been holding a terrible secret and living in grave fear for her life. For 6 months, ever since the day the FBI showed up on her doorstep.
They had come across a threat to Amy's life on the internet.
In early 2016, hackers broke into a hitman-for-hire website known as Besa Mafia. Those hackers turned their information to the FBI, a list of people being targeted for murder by Besa Mafia. One of the names on that list, Amy Allwine.
Law enforcement learned that a individual with the username Dog Day God posed the question to Besa Mafia, will you kill this person?
FBI agents were certain this was no case of mistaken identity. Dog Day God had made it very clear who was to be killed.
There was a series of emails back and forth between Besa Mafia and Dog Day God, some of which include instructions on where Amy was going to be going for a dog competition, the place she was staying at that location. Uploaded a picture of Amy to Besa Mafia so the so-called hitman would know precisely who to kill.
Dog Day God also handed over plenty of money to ensure getting the job done.
Dog Day God ultimately paid Besa Mafia about $12,000 in Bitcoin.
Sergeant McAllister explains why Bitcoins were used instead of cash.
It's an electronic currency that's essentially anonymous. You can sell them, exchange them, and it's really, really difficult to track. So it's sort of the currency of choice on the dark web.
Assistant County Attorney Jamie Kreuser says because Besa Mafia was on the dark web, the FBI had no way to identify Dog Day God.
By being on the dark web, you cannot be monitored. What you are looking at, what you are typing in, what you are trying to do, buy, sell, it is unmonitored.
Fortunately for Amy Allwine, the Hitman for Hire website was a fraud. Besa Mafia was taking people's money, but not carrying out any killings.
They were defrauding would-be criminals, if you will.
But though Besa Mafia may not have been real, the threat to Amy Allwine's life was.
Amy had to be terrified.
Yeah, she was absolutely terrified.
Terrified and confused. Steve and Amy had no idea who'd want her dead. And the only thing the FBI could tell them...
Whomever was Dog Day God was intent on having Amy Allwine killed.
But identifying that person would be nearly impossible. That's when the Allwines take drastic steps to protect themselves.
So Steven goes out and he buys a handgun.
Yep.
What type of gun?
A 9mm pistol.
They install an extensive security system at their home, which sits on 26 acres off a rural road.
They installed some security cameras and a security system from Xfinity. They also installed one of those Ring video doorbells.
They even left the country for a couple weeks, only telling the people who were traveling with them.
They went to Germany, and it was part of their church. And we did learn that Amy actually rested as well as she had rested all summer. She knew, being in Germany, that any potential killer probably wasn't going to be able to track her there.
But when she returned home, the threats continued. This time in the form of a couple of cryptic emails.
In the email, it basically said, you need to commit suicide, otherwise we're going to harm the rest of your family.
Then, the reason why. Someone using the name Jane alleges Amy ruined her life by having an affair with her husband, saying, quote, I do not know how a fat expletive like you got to my husband, but because of you, he left, and my life has become expletive. Commit suicide. If you do not, then you will slowly see things taken away from you, and each time you will know that you could have stopped it, which will eat you apart from the inside. The sender even provided Amy with a list of best ways to kill herself. Shotgun to the head, cyanide, inhaling gas, slitting wrist.
Also in the email were identifiers, if you will. I know where your gas meter is, and identifying certain people and their addresses that would be harmed if she didn't commit suicide.
Jane even mentioned specifics about the Allwines' young son, saying, quote, I saw last Friday he was wearing a bright pink shirt, and made it appear that she'd been watching Amy. I see that you moved the RV.
All the emails were coming in as anonymous emails, and they were used through an email anonymizer. Virtually untraceable.
In closing, the sender warned, unless you are a heartless, selfish expletive, then I expect to see your obituary in the paper in the next couple weeks.
Are you thinking this Jane woman could be responsible for this? And staging the scene?
Yeah, I mean, that's part of the mix.
When Amy Allwine was found shot to death inside her home in Cottage Grove, Minnesota, everyone in the small town was stunned, especially her next-door neighbors.
The crime lab van was in the driveway for 3 days, and nobody would talk to us about it. And detectives would come and interview us, and I would say, what? What?
Jean and Lee Kocher say they couldn't get any answers from cops and suddenly felt unsafe in their own home.
Like, you know, if somebody dies, you say, oh, they had a heart attack. They, you know, they wouldn't tell us anything. They just said, no, there's more going on.
Cops quickly determined Amy's death wasn't a suicide like her husband first suspected. She was murdered.
This was really a classic whodunit.
In the months leading up to her killing, there were threats on Amy's life. Prosecutor Fred Fink says someone using the name Dog Day God paid $12,000 to a fake hitman-for-hire website called Face a Mafia.
Do you think that they realized this website was a fraud at some point?
Ultimately, after they paid $12,000, yes.
A few months later, the preacher's wife received emails from someone using the name Jane.
The email began by accusing Amy of having an affair with this sender's husband, ruining her life. She was going to make sure that she ruined Amy's if Amy did not kill herself.
But as they dug deep to find the identity of the possible killer, Detective Randy McAllister says they couldn't find any evidence that Amy had ever cheated on her husband.
You went through her phone, her emails, her social media, all of her transactions?
Her computers, everything. There was zero indication she would step out on her husband or was stepping out on him.
Washington County detectives believe Jane and Dog Day God are the same person. But who is it? And why did they want Amy Allwine dead so badly?
I appreciate you coming in. This is a vexing situation, and I know it's hard for you.
A couple days after his wife's death, Stephen Allwine meets with detectives for more than 2 hours.
We certainly weren't zeroing in on Stephen.
Cops just wanted to know more about the threats on Amy's life, because prior to her death, the case had been handled by the FBI.
When she received these emails, was there a gut feeling or somebody you attributed these to?
Stephen said he had no clue who'd want to kill his wife.
The idea that somebody who just out of the blue want to kill somebody out of our family is just... obscene.
And as for the emails alleging she was having an affair,
did you guys discuss that?
We did. She did not have an affair.
What cops didn't tell Stephen initially is that they no longer believed his wife committed suicide.
What do you think happened to Amy?
I don't know. It looked to me like she shot herself. I don't know why she did.
Stephen claims the day his wife died, she hadn't been feeling well. He says it got so bad, her father came to pick up their son so he could take Amy to urgent care. But she decided not to go.
Every time I'd ask her if she was okay, she'd say yes.
Shortly after 5 o'clock, he checked on her one last time before heading out to pick up their son.
I poked my head in, and she was kneeling next to the bed at that point. Position she's normally in when she's praying. So I figured she was busy. I said, you know, I'm going to go pick up.
Stephen says he left around 5:30, and when he returned 90 minutes later, Amy was dead.
I saw her on the floor, saw blood. I said, don't come out. I said, mommy's dead.
Towards the end of the interview, cops drop a little truth bomb on Stephen. Investigators found blood throughout his house using luminol, blood that someone had obviously tried to clean up.
I could see that it looked like to be some blood on the wood floor just outside the bedroom that had been cleaned. Do you have any information about that?
No.
Detectives even offer possible explanations for how the blood may have gotten there.
Were there any injuries by anyone in the house that may have been bleeding?
Not that I know of.
When you checked on Amy, do you recall getting blood on you in any way?
I don't remember.
But in addition to the cleaned up pool of blood in the hallway, luminol also revealed bloody footprints throughout the house.
Stephen's shoe size is what?
12.
He's a 12. And the bare feet on the floor, the one that was illuminated, was what size?
Approximately, it was measured to be around a 12 as well.
Again, detectives try to help Stephen come up with an explanation for this seemingly incriminating evidence.
Do you recall if your socks had any blood on them? Any visual memory of that?
I don't recall.
It doesn't seem at this point that an intruder would be taking his or her shoes off and walking around a house.
Well, not just that, but coming into the house, taking their shoes off, locating the homeowner's gun, and shooting and killing Amy Allwine, and then cleaning up afterwards.
Even though all three doors to the Allwine's home are monitored 24 hours a day with surveillance cameras, Stephen did have an explanation for how an intruder might have gotten inside undetected.
There are only two that are recorded, though. A couple of reasons for that. One is it's an extra fee each month to record them. Yeah, we figured with the one in the back with the dogs moving around out back there, we'd be sending him a bunch of useless information.
Not only did the camera on the sliding glass door not record, Stephen said the door didn't lock properly.
It seems that if you were in fear for your life, you would, number one, get the door fixed, and number two, make sure that area is covered well.
We thought so.
But aside from the entry points, cleaned up blood, and bloody footprints, the lack of blood elsewhere also raised suspicions.
There wasn't any on the comforter on the bed, which to me says that the comforter was changed, that the one that was on the bed when she was killed there was not the one that we were looking at once we got there.
Do you think it's possible the killer burned a lot of the evidence?
That's our theory, yes.
That's because despite it being an unseasonably warm November day, cops found a big fire burning in the stove that heats the Allwines home.
It's such a hot temperature, it would get rid of anything.
Before wrapping up, cops had one very important question for Stephen.
You haven't had an intimate relationship with anyone, have you?
No.
During the marriage?
The preacher who counsels couples at his church was about to make a bombshell admission, one he'd never told anyone.
A couple of years ago, I had a short appointment sometime.
And was Amy aware of that?
No, she wasn't.
Okay.
Nobody was.
The preacher confesses to having an affair with a woman he met online named Michelle.
Did you share that with the FBI when they were doing threat evaluations?
No.
He says it was brief, but couldn't remember exactly when it began or when it ended.
It's on a little crass, but I don't remember exactly when we had sex first.
No, I understand. I wouldn't expect you to.
I'm sorry.
Besides Michelle, have there been any other romantic relationships?
No.
Dating back 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that's been the one infidelity in her 2 decades of marriage.
Yes.
Okay.
Cops question if Stephen's ex-lover perhaps wanted his wife out of the picture.
In your estimation, does Michelle have the capacity to have any involvement in what happened Sunday?
Detectives were done asking questions, but their investigation of Stephen Allwine was just starting.
I know that the FBI already looked at the two personal computers upstairs. Today, you don't have any objection to us looking into that.
No.
Oh, about 9 minutes left, but we're near the bottom of the hour break. I warned you at the beginning. Pastor, possible infidelity, yes. Possibility of hiring a hitman, he thought so. So apparently it sounds like this guy may have paid a somewhat interesting-looking website $12,000 to off his wife, and they never intended on doing that because they took the money and ran. He had a extramarital affair once within their 20 years of marriage. He doesn't know when it started or end, which is understandable. And apparently somebody who broke into his house and shot his wife, it wasn't a suicide, but somebody who broke into the house just ran around the house in socks or barefoot. I forget if it was socks or barefoot, which would be important to remember if I was ever testifying. Interesting, interesting, interesting. See, I keep telling people, first of all, you don't go to jail because you're smart and good looking. Secondly, if you want to commit as close to the perfect crime as possible, there is a wealth of information online, right? There are numerous stories. You can listen to various crime shows nonstop, take copious notes, and do your best to get away with the perfect. Now, I think the only real way to commit a perfect crime is this. There's a Twilight Zone episode years and years ago where a woman was, I think she was planting flowers or something, doing some yard work. And she dug up this necklace. And she ended up yes, I agree, Pat. She dug up a necklace and she wore it. And every time she said, oh, be quiet, time stopped. So the family was arguing. She said, oh, just be quiet. She did the dishes in peace and read a book and did whatever. It took time to make the dinner. Went to the grocery store at her leisure. So if you had that ability to stop time, you could probably commit the perfect murder. I don't know if it was really done. I mean, you could literally drive hours away or minutes away. No, you know, miles away. Murder somebody. Say, start talking, murder them. Then drive back to your location. And people would say, no, no, he's been here all day. I've got 37 witnesses. And there'd be no way, even if they found some of your DNA at the site. Like, wait a minute. There are 35 people, or he was currently doing Revolution Radio. And he said, I'll be back after this break. And if we know the break lasts, you know, 2.5 minutes or so, I could go and murder somebody and come back. The 37 of you would all be witnesses. No, no. He was in the chat room. He was there. That's how you commit the perfect crime. You have the ability to stop time. You can do anything. You can buy groceries at your leisure. You can sleep all day. Nothing would ever be late. You wouldn't even need to work. You just randomly walk around to stores and, you know, take money out of tills. Or you go to bars and you just take money out of tills. That's all you do. You just go and reach your hand in a bunch of drunk college kids' pockets and take all their money. They don't know the difference. You rob a cash truck. All right, folks, here's the bottom of the hour break. We'll finish this up and then visit our friends with our bedtime stories to conclude the show. Thanks for listening.
From this day to that, for one chance, just one chance, to come back here and tell our enemies that they may take our lives, but they'll never take our freedom!
The future is uncertain, I know this. Death is inevitable, I know this. But one thing is certain, as free men, it is our right to live unencumbered and in peace. And those times are quickly drawing to an end. And in these times, peace is certainly an illusion. And as the chains grow tighter, our ability to slip those chains increase incrementally with every passing moment. Inaction is no longer an option. It's time to raise our voices like a cacophony of thunder and lightning and tell the masters no more. And this is Nighthawk, and I say, for myself, no more. Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, because the freedom is slipping away.
Hey guys, Scorpio here. Join me every Saturday at 2 p.m. here on Studio A for the Scorpio Conspiracy Show, where we discuss the hidden agendas that impact our lives and uncover the secret societies and the shadowy elite who construct the reality that we are supposed to believe. So be there Saturdays, 2 p.m. Eastern Time, here on Studio A on Revolution Radio, and learn what's really going down.
The little honey on the lone highway left me for another on a lone highway. They killed Dirty Dog McGee on the lone highway.
Did you ever feel that things were not quite right? That everything was just ever so slightly askew?
Do you have, to paraphrase Morpheus, a splinter in your mind?
If you're interested in hearing the latest information about UFOs, the paranormal,
ancient cultures and structures,
monatomic elements,
longevity,
fantastic discoveries in science,
download it to your brain,
then tune in to us. Hi, I'm Dave.
And I'm Mackie.
And we as Shiny Side Out, Sundays 2 to 4 a.m. Eastern. See you then.
Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. You don't need to expect us. We're already here. All right. Thanks for listening while we took that short break here at Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. And now we're going to get back to your host.
All right. Let's wrap up the case of the preacher's murdered wife.
In the days following the murder of Amy Allwine, cops in Cottage Grove, Minnesota, quickly realized they don't need to look far to find a suspect.
As evidence started coming in, there was a lot of information that we found out about Steve that started to focus our attention strictly at Steve.
Ironically, much of that evidence was found on the IT specialist's own computers.
You seized more than 60 pieces of electronics.
Yep. Multiple cell phones, computers, hard drives, thumb drives, all sorts of electronics.
Prosecutor Fred Fink says Stephen Allwine lied to cops during his interrogation when he said he only had one affair. Remember this?
A couple of years ago, I had a short appointment.
Either man, he had all magic relationships.
Mm-hmm. You found at least three other affairs.
Yes.
Despite the pastor's role as a couple's counselor at his church, prosecutors say Stephen Allwine spent lots of time searching for women online and not just on any ordinary dating website.
Stephen Allwine went on a website called Ashley Madison and he began communicating with women. This continued throughout the time that Amy Allwine was in fact killed.
Ashley Madison is designed specifically for married people looking to have an affair. Detectives say Stephen had affairs with at least two women he met on the site.
Did he meet them on multiple occasions?
The one female, yes, he had a significant relationship with her over the course of many months. They took trips together.
They also found a woman Stephen met on Backpage.com who he paid for sex.
Was it alarming to you when you found out this man of God, this Christian marriage counselor, was having so many affairs?
Certainly speaks to his character, I think. And possibly that speaks to a little motivation as well for the murder.
Stephen himself told cops his church doesn't condone divorce.
We believe that marriage is a covenant not just between the man and the woman, but with God as well. And so, unless you knowingly break that covenant, then we don't divorce.
Instead of divorce, Sergeant Randy McAllister believes Stephen chose murder as a way out of their marriage.
I think it's safe to say he was nationally known within the denomination, maybe internationally known. So he was kind of a big deal in the church, too. And we kind of think that maybe he didn't want to lose that standing because that was really important to him.
Cops were quickly closing in on Stephen Allwine when they suddenly stumbled upon their biggest break in the case yet.
The Bitcoin wallet address that was found in December was key.
Prosecutors say a 34-digit code found on Stephen Allwine's computer matches a Bitcoin code and proves that he is Dog Day God, the person who tried to hire a hitman on the dark web to kill Amy Allwine. A computer forensics expert says the code was first typed in the Notes app on Stephen's iPhone.
20 seconds after that note was created on Stephen Allwine's password-protected iPhone, it was posted by Dog Day God on the Besa Mafia website. The message said, "Help, I posted the wrong Bitcoin code. This is the one that I meant to use."
Less than a minute later, the code was deleted from Stephen's iPhone, but it was too late. It had already been uploaded to his computer through the cloud.
Apparently, when you sync iTunes between your computer and your phone, the cloud just sucks everything out of your phone.
What Stephen should have known as an IT specialist.
Delete does not always mean delete.
Investigators soon find evidence they say proves Stephen was also behind the emails to his wife, demanding she commit suicide.
the day before Amy got the first email from so-called Jane threatening her, the defendant had been on his computer and had accessed Rodriguez.com and received the various addresses of Amy's relatives.
The addresses not only appear in the email, the sender even admits to using the Rodriguez website to find them.
Do you think he had any idea that you were finding all of this against him?
I don't think so. I think Stevens thinks he's smarter than most people.
Detectives then discover what they believe was the first attempt to kill Amy Allwine that day, one that nearly went unnoticed.
We had found an internet posting just doing an open source search from this Dog Day God looking for a drug called scopolamine.
Detective Lankamer says when taken in large doses, the drug causes a person to hallucinate and become disoriented.
Down in Colombia, it's pretty prevalent as a date rape drug.
A test for the drug in Amy's system turned up an obscene amount.
It was about 45 times the normal.
45 times the normal?
Yeah, somewhere around there based on her blood levels. And they found huge amounts of scopolamine in her stomach.
Detectives allege Stephen put the drug in his wife's lunch the day she was murdered.
Which would explain the symptoms she was experiencing because those symptoms match scopolamine poisoning.
Detective Lankamer believes Stephen was hoping the drug would kill his wife.
And if she would have died of poisoning, that would have been the way out?
I think so. Mm-hmm. It's such an obscure drug that it's not normal to test for that.
When the poisoning didn't work, cops allege he shot her in the head instead, staging the scene as a suicide and allowing his son to find his mom's body.
What kind of father allows something like this to happen?
It's certainly the question that all of us ask.
It's a disgusting move. It really is.
2 months after his wife's murder, Stephen Allwine was arrested and charged with second-degree murder.
Where was he arrested?
We waited till he dropped his son off at school, and we conducted a traffic stop.
And do you think he was surprised?
He didn't show it.
Stephen made bail and returned home. His neighbors were terrified.
And the police kept telling me, you don't have to worry about anything. He's not going to go after anybody. He just hated his wife.
2 months later, Stephen Allwine was back behind bars after being indicted on one count of first-degree premeditated murder. He remained there until his trial in January. Kevin DeVore was Stephen's attorney.
Were you confident going into this trial?
I was confident, but I've tried enough cases to know that I had some obstacles.
His biggest obstacle was the Bitcoin code found on Stephen Allwine's computer, the same code that was used to hire a hitman to kill Amy.
How did you explain that?
Well, there was evidence that the Allwine's computer system had been compromised. I would say hacked would be the right word for it.
Kevin DeVore argued there was no physical proof that Stephen himself actually typed that code into his iPhone.
It's all proof by way of computer records. And so it was the opinion of the forensic scientists that, as their expert testified in the trial, any phone could be labeled S. Allwine iPhone.
But jurors didn't buy the explanation. After just 8 hours of deliberations, they found Stephen Allwine guilty of murdering his wife.
What's one of the biggest mistakes Stephen made in all of this?
He thought with his internet knowledge and his smarts that he was covering all his tracks. He didn't.
2 days after the verdict was handed down, Stephen was sentenced to life in prison and addressed the court for the first time.
There was no remorse for his actions. He stated that he loved his wife.
He also said his wife's killer is still out there.
You do not believe an unknown intruder entered that house and killed Amy?
Not as much as a green Martian came down from Saturn and did it. Absolutely not.
A family life shattered. Before being led away in handcuffs, the preacher turned convicted killer promised to continue spreading his faith.
He said that he has changed lives while being held at our local jail, and that as he was processed into prison, he would be bringing his Bible and continuing his ministry.
In an isolated rural corner of South Carolina, there is an area of swampland that has come to gain no small amount of notoriety. Is this inhospitable region home to one of North America's most infamous cryptids? Join us as we delve into the secret of Skapor Swamp. On a cold midweek morning in February of 2008, Bob Rawson whispered goodbye to his sleeping wife, Dixie, before slipping out of his front door to go to work. It was still dark as he crossed the open ground between the farmhouse and the spot where the family truck was parked, but as he neared his vehicle, his hand ferreting in a cavernous jacket pocket for his keys, he caught sight of something which caused him to take a sharp intake of breath. The switchboard operator for the Lee County Sheriff's Department had struggled to understand the content of the panicked phone call she had subsequently received from Mr. Rawson. He needed help urgently, as a crime had been committed. No, nobody had been hurt, and no, he didn't know who was responsible. But he and his family were not safe, and they needed police protection immediately. The two deputies who were dispatched to the Rawson farmstead were intercepted by the homeowner well before they had chance to turn off the main highway and onto the road leading up to his property. Torches in hand, they had followed closely behind as he had half run to where his truck was situated, gesticulating in an animated fashion at the front of the parked vehicle. In the dim torchlight, they could see that extensive damage had been caused to the vehicle's exterior. But it was only when they looked more closely that they realized why Rawson was so agitated. Parts of the front wheel arches on both sides of the truck had been twisted and bent outwards, so they now jutted out at right angles from the main chassis. The surface of these damaged strips of metal was scratched and covered with indentations, almost as if they had been chewed upon. Damage of a similar nature was to be found on the vehicle's front grille, where in places, the metal had been pierced right through, as if bitten by a wild animal of some kind. Struggling to come up with a satisfactory hypothesis, the two officers had called for a crime scene examiner in a bid to identify who or what was responsible. Samples taken from the damaged metalwork were sent off for analysis, and a week later, it was confirmed that canine DNA had been recovered from the swabs. But when detectives reattended to share this information, Rawson had merely shaken his head in disbelief. Without speaking a word, he had led the officers across his property to a field in which the bodies of a number of dead animals lay. In addition to the remains of several domesticated cats, there were a number of dead cow carcasses and a corpse of a recently departed coyote. In calm and clear terms, Mr. Rawson explained that the DNA the analysts had found most likely belonged to the coyote, but it had come from the mouth of whatever had killed and eaten the animal before subsequently attacking his truck. The Rawson farm was being stalked by an unseen attacker, one which resided in the neighboring swamp and had been haunting the area for over 20 years. The cities of Sumter and Bishopsville are as indistinct as any other found dotted around the rural reaches of South Carolina. Indeed, were it not for the region of dense swampland which separates them, these two communities may well have remained in quiet anonymity, with no reason whatsoever to invite the attention of the national press. But even from the day that this inhospitable patch of land was first named, it has flirted with notoriety. What most local historians agree upon is that Skapor Swamp earned its title from the phrase Escaped Whore Swamp, in reference to a long-past incident involving a local female of ill repute. It is here, though, that the disagreements begin, as it appears that the region possesses more than its fair share of stories involving ladies of the night. One tale has the woman in question being driven out of a nearby town by the angry wives of her clients. Another, more colourful version is believed to have occurred during the Revolutionary War, when a group of local militiamen surprised an encampment of British soldiers who were entertaining some of the local prostitutes. Having captured their opponents, the revolutionaries then drove the women away and deeper into the marshland. But the incident which would truly propel Skapor Swamp into the national consciousness would occur many years later, in the early hours of the 29th of June, 1988. At approximately 2 o'clock that morning, a local youth by the name of Christopher Davis was driving home from his shift at a nearby diner when his car sustained a flat tire. Davis coasted the vehicle to a spot just off the main road and immediately set about changing the tire in question. The highway had been quiet, with no other vehicles passing by. He had just deposited the damaged tire in the boot of his car and was wiping the dirt from his hands when there was a rustling sound in the bushes behind him. When he turned around to look, there was nobody there. But as he closed the boot lid of his car, he heard the rustling sound again. Attempting to stifle a growing feeling of apprehension, Davis slowly walked back to the passenger side door and retrieved a torch from the glove box. Switching it on, he directed the beam into the bushes where the noise had emanated from, but there was nothing to be seen. As he took a step backwards away from the foliage, lowering the torch so that the light was now pointing towards the ground, a huge dark shape suddenly emerged from the brush. Davis instinctively raised the torch again to illuminate the figure before immediately dropping it to the ground and crying out in terror. Bolting over to the driver's side door, the terrified teen frantically fumbled for the door handle, his mind utterly traumatized by what he had just seen. The creature that had been advancing towards him was between 6 and 7 feet tall, dark green in color, with water glistening and dripping from the scales that covered its naked body. He leapt into the driver's seat and immediately gunned the ignition, only for the car to be rocked from side to side by a violent impact. With a sickening feeling, Davis glanced in his mirror to see a ghoulish face leering back at him through the car's rear window. A pair of menacing red eyes regarded him, which almost seemed to glow when the moonlight caught them, whilst a mouth full of misshapen teeth opened and closed beneath them. The teen let out another cry, flooring the pedal and sending the car hurtling back up onto the highway. Over the roar of the engine, he heard several loud bangs, and then a scrabbling noise on the roof of the car directly above him, before another heavy impact shook the vehicle. Panicking, he slammed down hard on the brakes and watched in disbelief as a huge shape was immediately thrown onto the road in front of him. In the intense beams of the car headlights, he could see that the creature was broad and muscular, with 3 talon claws at the end of each of its hands. For a moment, it lay motionless, before its head suddenly snapped to the side, staring back at him. In a heartbeat, Davis again floored the accelerator, the car shooting off down the highway and leaving the creature lying where it fell. Several days later, when the teenager learned that the local sheriff's office was investigating a report in Browntown of a parked car having been attacked by a mysterious creature, he called the police. Deputies attended his home address, photographing the deep scratch marks on the boot and roof of his vehicle, as well as a missing wing mirror, before asking him to take them back to the scene of the encounter. Davis showed the officers the tire marks which demonstrated where he had braked hard to dislodge the creature from his roof, before leading them onto the bushes from where it had first emerged. Strange tracks were discovered in the thick mud just inside the tree line, and so plaster casts were taken and sent off to the South Carolina Marine Resources Department for analysis. A few days later, Sheriff Liston Truesdale received a phone call from a Dr. Evans, informing him that the casts had been of a large foot with three clawed toes, and that they did not match anything that the department kept on file. As the weeks progressed, there would be further overnight attacks on vehicles, with deep gouges and bite marks found by their owners the following morning. These incidents, as well as further sightings of a large lizard-like creature, would intensify during the following month, all centered on a five-mile patch of swampland on the outskirts of Bishopsville. Then, on August the 5th, an off-duty airman reported that he had shot and wounded a creature that had attacked him on Highway 15. Since then, there have only been sporadic sightings of the Skapor Lizard Man, but these have stubbornly persisted up until the present day. As beguiling as the tale is of a lizard man emerging from his swamp to spend his evenings chasing passing motorists before attacking their vehicles, the Skapor story is not without its flaws. And one of the greatest undermining factors of the tale is the testimony of Kenneth Orr, the man who was alleged to have injured the beast in the weeks following the original Christopher Davis encounter. When the airman contacted police to report his actions, he also handed over what appeared to be blood and tissue samples he had recovered from the scene of the incident. 2 days later, Orr found himself being arrested for illegal possession of a firearm and making a false report to the police. When he subsequently appeared at trial, he stated to the court that he had fabricated the entire incident for attention. No records of the tissue analysis he had provided, or the reasons for his sudden change of heart, have ever been revealed, prompting suspicions about the integrity of the police investigation. Perhaps curiously, however, the Skapor Swamp Monster is only one of a colourful gallery of reptilian monsters who are alleged to haunt the highways and byways of the United States. Indeed, it appears that the Sasquatches, which apparently saturate the North American continent, have a significant amount of cold-blooded competition. During the 1950s, the city of Loveland, Ohio, was plagued by sightings of oversized aquatic monsters. Motorists reported that whilst driving at night, they had seen what they described as tall, frog-like entities either crossing the main highways ahead of them or fleeing into the safety of the nearby bodies of water. Over time, these entities became known as the Loveland Frogs, with reports concerning the creatures continuing until the spring of 1972. Following a fresh wave of nocturnal sightings, police officers shot and killed a 4-foot-long iguana, which was believed to have escaped from a local collector. With this animal's death, sightings of the Loveland Frog also quickly ceased. Several months later, two youths who were fishing on the shores of a lake in British Columbia reported seeing a scaly creature which had sharp claws and spikes on its head swimming through the nearby waters. When further witnesses to the incident also later came forward, the legend of the Thetis Lake Monster was born. However, much like the Skapor Lizard Man and Loveland Frogs before it, this new creature ended up being dismissed as the product of overactive imaginations. Investigators were quick to point out that the description of the Canadian cryptid was strikingly similar to the creature featured in the movie Monster from the Surf, which had been screened on local television only 4 days before. Returning to the dark and foreboding depths of Skapor Swamp, the authorities maintain that the creature which was encountered is likely to be either an alligator or a large monitor lizard. In poor weather or lighting, and under severe levels of stress, they propose that witnesses have misidentified everyday creatures, believing that they were standing upright on two legs when they were more likely either clambering or rearing up in an aggressive manner. The damage to motor vehicles has been laid at the door of coyotes and bears, or even attributed to human offenders. Much as it was alleged that pranksters have sought to cash in on the famed Mothman sightings in West Virginia during the 1960s, there are suggestions that local residents have manufactured sightings of the Lizard Man in order to increase tourism in the region.
All right, folks, we've got to cut that bedtime story short, just a tad bit short. There was only about 90 seconds left, but this gives me time to remind you we are 100% listener supported, located at revolution.radio, common spelling from any web browser, to the 37 people in the chat room this evening. Thanks for sticking around. Up next on Studio B, it is The Tipping Point with Scott McKay. Excuse me, followed by The Right Stuff with Robert Morningstar. Over on Studio A coming up is The Fenton Perspective with Lorian Fenton, followed by Open Canvas with The Mad Painter. And then Wild at Heart Roundtable on A starting at midnight Eastern Time. Over on Studio B, it's Spaced Out Radio or SOR Radio. Or SOR, I'm sorry, with Dave Scott starting at midnight Eastern Time. Here comes the music. I will talk with you folks on Thursday. Thanks for listening in the words of Katie Couric. Good night, y'all.
Revolution.